The following Bible study is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
Chapter 7. And there was a difference in chapter 7 whereby Daniel now received in the first year of Belshazzar, he received a vision. And in that vision, he saw pretty much the same kingdoms in the image that he saw in the dream. In this case, it was a vision, and he saw these same nations, these same empires in chronological order, but he saw them in terms of beasts. We learned that the reason God uses beasts to represent kingdoms is because that's how they act. They're butting each other, they're ripping, they're tearing, clawing at one another for more power, more territory, whatever. And so what we saw then was a lion, a bear, and a leopard, and then a beast that was ferocious, vicious, different from all the rest. And the lion again represented Babylon, the bear represented Persia, and of course that bear still, you understand those dome-shaped architectural design that we see in the country of Russia is from the Persian influence. And you can see the Arabic flavor there. And the bear is their symbol to this day. And the leopard then pictured the Greek Empire, and the four heads actually represented Alexander's very swift approach to battle, and had four heads. And these were the four different generals that the kingdom finally went to after him. Then the last beast, of course, what was ferocious, was the Roman Empire. And so Daniel watched in this vision until all of these beasts were destroyed, till God's kingdom was set up, and the kingdom, it says, was given to the saints of the Most High. And so remember this, that we are designed, called, in fact, to rule. And so never forget this. It's not about salvation. It isn't a case of we're just all going to be saved and all be together. But Christ is now working to pick those he's going to use in leadership roles in his kingdom. And so everything we do really matters. In other words, Christ wants to know, okay, who do I know I can send to the outermost reaches of the universe and turn my back and know that that person is always going to execute my will faithfully? Because those are the people he'll use for leaders. And so I think there's a paramount lesson in chapter 7 about this thing. The kingdom is given to the saints. He's going to entrust the kingdom of God to us. And so for that reason, we've got to make sure we realize what we're qualifying for here. Salvation is a free gift, but we are qualifying for positions of leadership in the kingdom of God. So next, in chapter 8, Daniel has another vision. This is 3 years later. It's in the third year of Belshazzar. And now the language, the original language, changes from Arabic that it's been since chapter 2. It's been in Arabic. It now changes to Hebrew. And there's a reason for this. I'm convinced the language now changes in chapter 8. Because the Jews, he wanted the Jews to be able to read chapter 8 for sure. Everyone he wanted in the empire to be able to read chapter 7 about the four kingdoms. But now we're going to see some kingdoms that come right after Babylon that bear directly on the Jews. And so he wanted this written in their language. And so he wrote it for them. For this reason, Daniel 8 and verse 1, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. And so he receives another vision similar to the first one. In verse 2, and I saw in a vision, and it came to pass, when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Ulai. Let's go over to Esther 1, if you would, for a minute. Daniel saw himself here in Shushan. Now, it wasn't in the palace exactly. It's really the palace was more of a fortress there. And this is of some significance. We'll see this. It's also by a river, and that river passes the ruins today on the west side of it. Shushan was about 450 miles from Seleucia, and the city became the resident of Persian kings. It would one day become the capital city of Persia, and that was very soon, because Persia was the next empire that was going to take Babylon. Esther 1, verse 1 and 2 says this, "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus," this is Ahasuerus, "which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces, that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the palace." And so what I'm getting at here is that Persia eventually took over the kingdom, and this area here became, it was at one point, the summer palace for Persian kings. And eventually it became the very center there, a capital city of the Persian Empire. Now, it's possible that Daniel could have ended up in this very place. Now, it says that he saw this in a vision, but yet after the Babylonian Empire was taken down and the Persian Empire then took over and this city became a capital city, it's possible Daniel could have gone there because he was used, as he was under Nebuchadnezzar, he was used by the Persian king as well, Cyrus and so on. But here's why I say this. The ruins of Shushan are still there. You can go there, they say, and pick up pieces of pottery and pieces of brick and mortar and things still from that city today. And down at the bottom of a mound is a small building, and this is called the Tomb of Daniel. And it's a place that is a pilgrimage place where people go there, and it's a tourist attraction for many other people. But it still exists today in a city that is completely in ruins. I mean, that whole place is nothing but gloominess, and they say every kind of wild animal lives there now. There's nothing there except this one little tiny place that's called Daniel's Tomb. So whether it is or not is hard to say at this point, but it's possible that he may have ended up working there for the Persian Empire after they took over and could have possibly even died there. Now, some people believe that he actually received this vision being at the city Shushan, and that he may have been on a diplomatic mission or something like that. If you read commentaries, they'll say such things. But I want to take issue with this, because as you remember, when Belshazzar was having that great feast and everything, he didn't even know Daniel. So how would Daniel have been on a diplomatic mission for him at that time? Daniel was probably pretty much in retirement, if you will. And then notice the wording of the verse. Daniel, if you see it, starts with the vision. It seems to state that he sees himself in Shushan by the river. Now, you remember other cases in Ezekiel where he would be moved to a place in Israel because he'd be prophesying about Israel. And so God would take him in vision to that very place. But he never went there. He was just in vision there. And I suggest that he's standing here seeing this vision from this place that is going to be the capital city of the next empires that are to come. And for that reason, he is taken to that place. Look at Daniel 8 and verse 3. "Then I lifted up my eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last." And so what we see here is that this ram pictures the Medo-Persian Empire. And that two horns, whenever you see the symbolism of a horn, it indicates a power or a military might or something like that. And you hear often phrases like the horn of my strength or the horn of my power. You'll read those kinds of phrases throughout the Bible. And this is talking about two horns that are these empires. Now, verse 20 says this. If you go over to verse 20 real quickly, "The ram which you saw having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia." And this again is a reminder that God will interpret the prophecies for us. We should never try to interpret the symbolism in the Bible, that he will always show it to us. So anyway, the two horns are these two empires which were allied at the time. The Median Empire grew up first, but in the end was smaller. The Persian Empire came up later, but it ended up being the greatest. And that's what these two horns represent. In verse 4, "I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward so that no beast might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will, and he became great." And so the various surrounding empires were helpless against the Medes and the Persian. The Rand pushed west, that would be toward Macedonia or Greece today, pushed north towards the Caucasus and the Scythians, and it pushed towards Babylon, and ultimately Egypt towards the south. Now, no other empires were able to withstand his vicious attacks. He was able to do whatever he wanted. He became very great and full of pride, very much like his predecessors. Now, that is, Cyrus did, in particular. He became very prideful, and it seems to be the case of all of these rulers, that every one, remember Nebuchadnezzar, before God humbled him, and then the next one that comes is proud, and then we come to the Grecian Empire, and things really, really get bad after that. Anyway, the scene shifts now to Greece in verse 5. Let's go there. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat came up from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And so the he-goat comes from the west. And remember, the west then is Macedonia or Greece. And it pictures Alexander the Great coming out of the Greek Empire. And the phrase, touch not the ground, which refers again to this lightning speed at which he was able to conquer his foes. It was blitzkrieg. The original blitzkrieg, he was just so fast. Now, when it says one notable horn, of course, it's talking to one single man of great leadership. And Alexander the Great is notable. I mean, is there anyone here who hadn't heard of him before they started reading the Bible? It's kind of interesting, isn't it, when it says a notable one? I mean, there's a lot of leaders that came and went. Most of you will not have heard of Antiochus Epiphanes until we get into the Bible study or until you started reading the Bible. But everyone knows about Alexander the Great, and so it calls him a one notable one. And this is, of course, different from the coalition that had existed before this, which was the Medes and the Persians. This is one single leader. And then verse 6 and 7, and he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and smote the ram, and broke his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground, and stamped on him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. And so Alexander the Great came to the Persian Empire, and he came with a fury and a power, and he launched an unprovoked attack upon Persia in 34 B.C., smote them with only 30,000 foot soldiers and 5,000 horse soldiers. And he broke both horns, both the Medes and the Persians. And he destroyed, before this was over, 600,000 men from that empire. Can you imagine that, with 30,000 troops destroying 600,000? And it says this, it says he smote the ram, he cast it to the ground, and then he stamped on it. And some believe this refers to there were three main battles that took place here. And one was in Granicus, Issus, and Arabella. And he destroyed this many people. Anyway, none could deliver the ram out of his hand. And so it was that these Persians were much greater in men, much greater in equipment. They had trained army elephants in their ranks as well. But Alexander conquered these guys in 3.5 year period, and it stands unique in all of military history. The whole Near East and Middle East he took in 3 years. Amazing story. So anyway, in verse 8, therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And for it, that is in place of it, came up four notable ones towards the four winds of heaven. When it says he became very great, I think it means two things. One, of course, would be the extent of territory that he conquered. It was huge, massive, what he was able to do. But also, it could refer to his ego, because he thought of himself as being very great, and he began at the end of his career to begin to give himself divine titles. And when he liberated Egypt from Persia, he got the priest to proclaim that he had descended from Zeus Amon. And he also, at one point, required his troops to prostrate themselves before him. But you'll see this. There's a little insanity in all the great men. the brilliant brilliant minds are often a little wacky. And, of course, with human nature and our self-centeredness, I mean, this is where it goes when you're all-powerful. So anyway, here he was at the height of his power. As the scriptures say, he was very strong. This great horn was then broken. And what happened was he died of a fever brought on by dissipation. And as the history books say, that he complained to his commanders in a drunken debauchery that he was just frustrated and depressed because there were no more empires to conquer. He had conquered them all. Why live? But anyway, he just treated himself in dissipation and finally died of a fever. After this, four notable horns came up. This refers to his empire being broken up by the four generals into four areas. They had four generals that were Alexander's that took different parts. Now, they tried after his death to hold the empire apart together, but it began to break down, and in 311, Seleucus asserted his independent rule in Babylon, and then the others began to follow suit. Cassander held on to Macedonia, Ptolemy, Egypt, and Lysicomus held the western part of Asia Minor. And so it was that we see this split again of the four heads of the leopard we saw in Daniel 7 are now reflected again now in four horns, the four-part division, which eventually, of course, crumbled, and the northern part went to Rome in time. And then a unique leader among all leaders emerges on the world scene. And the story of this man is probably the main reason why this whole chapter was written, and written in Hebrew for the Jews to understand. And it is this man, Antiochus. Daniel 8 and verse 9. And out of one of them came forth a little horn. That is one of these, the divisions of four. Out of one of those divisions came forth a little horn, which waxed exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and towards the pleasant land. Now, this little horn refers to Antiochus 4. And he's called a little horn, I believe, for this reason, because he was a base man. He was not princely. He was not a great commander, but he was more a man who you would consider to be contemptible, in a sense. And he chose the name Epiphanes, and this means manifest or illustrious. Now, later, he would add another part to this name, Theos. Theos. Manifest. You know what that means? God with us. God visible. He believed he was a god. He came from the Seleucid Empire, and after Seleucus Philopater had been assassinated, he took the vacant throne while the true heir to the throne was still held hostage in Rome. He first attacked Egypt to the south, pushed into Armenia in the east. And then he says he took over the glorious land, that is, the Holy Land. Now, this is where his reputation begins to become significant to you and to me and to the people of God. Antiochus attempted to cause religious conformity on all people, and he brutally suppressed the Jewish worship in Jerusalem. He became extremely powerful. In verse 10, it says this, "And he waxed great even to the host of heaven. And it cast down some of the host and the stars to the ground and stamped upon them." Now, this should probably read more like he waxed great against the host of heaven. And I want you to think about this and compare this language to Isaiah 14. As you remember, it says, "You've said in your heart, I will ascend unto heaven. I'll exalt my throne above the stars of God." And this, of course, was speaking to a human king of a city that lifts to Satan. And I believe it does so, as you remember in Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, talks about Tyre and so on. It does so because I believe that there are demonic forces, as we saw in the case of Hitler. And people that have written about this, he was deeply into the occult, and he would have these orgasms as he spoke sometimes. I mean, this man was influenced by demonic forces. And I believe there are other cases where great leaders from time to time are inspired by no less than the devil himself. Now listen, Antiochus didn't literally reach up, did he, and grab stars out of heaven and cast them down or anything. So I think there's two possible ways to understand this verse. And one would be that Antiochus actually made war on the gods, and that he made war on human beings who were in high religious positions. I think these are two ways to look at this. Think about this. The host of heaven is frequently referred to as stars in the Bible. And stars are symbolic of angelic beings and can refer to demonic forces. And so during the time of Antiochus, many of the people in the surrounding nations worshipped the stars. They actually thought the stars were gods. And that's why, you know, some of the astrology and the constellations and stuff that we see today comes from that. So Antiochus challenged all other religions. He put them down, and he made himself godlike over all the gods, and he desecrated all the other forms of religious worship in the whole area, and he stamped out the other religions. Okay? Now, here's another way to look at this, too. Antiochus not only made war on the people of Egypt and the East and the Holy Land, but he made war on the holy people of God. The host of heaven is also could be the, considered the people of God. And so the priests then and worshipers of God could be called this. Saints are God's people who have guardian angels, and the stars could reflect those guardian angels that take care of and watch over God's people. Let's go to Isaiah 24, and we'll take a brief look at another scripture where the host of heaven could refer to those in high ruling positions that he cast down. And the scriptures seem to use similar language here in Isaiah 24, verse 20. And here's scripture talking about the last days. And it says, the earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and shall be removed like a cottage, and the transgression thereof shall be heavy on it, and it shall fall and not rise again. And then it says, and it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, and the kings of the earth upon the earth. And so you see how this could be then interpreted, that Antiochus was going to cast down those who were the high-level rulers, the leaders, and so on, especially in the religious community. So let's go back to Daniel. He brought many religious rulers down. He killed many, and he acted in complete contempt towards the priests and the rulers. Daniel 8, verse 11 and 12. Yes, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down, and a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression. And it cast down the truth to the ground, and it, that is Antiochus, and his system practiced and prospered. Antiochus made himself greater than even God. This is the point at which he changed his name to Epiphanes, or God made manifest, made himself like a god, and magnified himself against the true God. You remember how Moses went to Pharaoh and he said, let my people go, you know, and I'm going to serve the Lord. And Pharaoh said, who is the Lord? Do you understand the mentality here? Who is God that I should be careful with these people or this place called Jerusalem? And so history shows this man operating like a beast, the most brutal in history. He hated God's religion, and he cast the true religion down. He ordered the Torah, the first five books of the law, to be destroyed whenever it was found. Anyone possessing a Torah or the Word of God was killed and sometimes tortured. He persecuted the Jews horribly. He forced them to eat pork. And if they wouldn't, they had to die. He'd kill anybody that tried to keep God's law. Now, he began to order families not to circumcise their babies. He found anyone that circumcised their babies, he would crucify the mother. He would take the babies, and he would take them out to the troops, and they'd throw them in the air, and they'd use their spears and arrows for target practice in the baby. And then they would take that baby and hang the child around the mother's neck. This is how cruel and barbarous, how brutal this man was. And this suppression came to a head in 168 BC. He was routed by a Roman general in Alexandria, Egypt, and he came back in incredible frustration because he had been beaten, and he took it out on the Jews in a terrible way. He sent Apollonius, his general, and 20,000 troops to seize Jerusalem on a Sabbath day, and they just pillaged and destroyed the temple. They took the lamps, the lavers, the implements, until the whole temple was completely bare. He expelled the godly high priest, that is what I think would be one of the hosts, as it were, Onias III, and he put his corrupt brother in his place who would do anything, and then the whole temple fell into disuse. He also, at this time, took the altar down that was God's altar, and he put up an altar there, a pagan altar, and he sacrificed a pig, a swine, on the altar in the temple. And then he put a statue of Jupiter Olympus in the temple of God. And this is recorded in the book of Maccabees. The book of Maccabees is not holy writ in the same way the Bible is, but it's an extremely accurate history. And in 1 Maccabees 1, verse 44 through 49, it says this: "The king had sent letters by messengers unto Jerusalem and the cities of Judah that they should follow the strange laws of the land and forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the temple, and that they should profane the Sabbaths and festival days and pollute the sanctuary and holy people. They set up altars and groves and chapels of idols and sacrifice swine's flesh and unclean beasts, that they should also leave their children uncircumcised and make their souls abominable with all manner of uncleanness and profanation, to the end that they might forget the laws and change all the ordinances." This guy was just brutal. That's just a historian writing what he did, but he doesn't tell all the details. But you can find this in Josephus. It's right there about how brutal he was. So anyway, two angels, this has come on all these people, and it's just a brutality that is a type. It's symbolic of what's going to happen in the tribulation to the people of God. And so two angels then discuss, how long is this going to go on? In Daniel 8 and verse 13 through 14, it says this: "And I heard one saint speaking to another saint, and said unto that certain saint which spoke, How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden under foot? And he said unto me, Unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed." And so anyway, he's asking him, how long is this going to go on? And the answer is 2,300 days. Now, this word days is of interest, because if you look it up in the Strong's, it's going to give you two words, and it's going to go Ereb and Boker. Does anybody remember those words from us doing the Passover? Ereb is evening, and Boker is morning. And so it's really saying for 2,300 evenings and mornings. And what this is referring to is the evening and morning sacrifice that was to occur every day. The lamps were to be lit, there was to be an oil offering, and there were to be sacrifices. And this is like in Leviticus 24, verse 3, says this: "Without the veil of the testimony in the tabernacle of the congregation shall Aaron order it from evening unto morning before the Lord continually. It should be a statute forever throughout your congregations or your generations." So for this reason, it's saying 2,300 dailies, or evening and mornings, referring to the evening and morning sacrifice. For this reason, the number 2,300 should be divided by two. And so it's not 2,300 days, it would be 2,300 evening and morning sacrifices, which comes out to 1,150 days. Now, this is how long the desecration of the temple and the sacrifices were done away during that time. Now, we don't exactly know when the sacrifices were stopped, but we know this: the abomination was set up in 167 BC in December, and the temple was rededicated to God then Kislev 25, that is December 14th in 164. Now, some will argue that this is not this three-year period is not 1,150 days. But Daniel wasn't trying to give us the exact dates here when he wrote this, but he was giving us the exact numbers. But he wasn't writing to prove that this would fit some other historical event. You see, he was just giving the numbers here. So historically, this comes out, I think, very, very close in this way, that if you had the three-year period, you have a period that is 1095 days. That's what that is, 3 years. Okay. Now, every third year, the Jews in their calendar have an intercalary month. So you have to add 30 days to that. And so that brings you up to within 25 days. Now, here's why it doesn't really matter, really, how many days, because all we can say is, okay, look, the temple was rededicated on this date. So we can work backwards and say, okay, 25 days before December 167, the sacrifices stopped. And they were then able to be reinstituted at a later date. So anyway, during this time, a very famous man named Judas Maccabee was prominent. And they called him the Hammer. That's his nickname. And the reason was because he just hammered at these Greek troops, Antiochus' soldiers. He would not give up. His family was so famous and they were so well respected, and he would not accept this. And he organized people like you and me to fight. And they would go in and they would make raids, and they'd make forays into the troops that were Antiochus' troops, and then they'd pull back and hide. They'd make forays in, they'd pull back and hide. And so just like a hammer, boom, 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 hitting these people. And then what happened was Antiochus eventually had to go fight some battles elsewhere. And while he was gone fighting other important battles in Egypt, why the troops were left behind were fairly limited. Maccabee kept hitting them, and he hit them until they fell. And here was a small band of just a few thousand men were able to knock out the Greek army of Antiochus Epiphanes. And it's just a momentous event. So anyway, after they had routed the army, Judas Maccabee wanted to rededicate the temple, and they all agreed. And so they set a date, and it was this day on Kislev, that is the Jewish month, but December 14th, 164 BC. And what they did was they rededicated the temple, and they had a festival there that lasted 8 days. And they called it the Festival of Light. The Festival of Lights. And so the Jews today, they still keep this, and it's called Hanukkah. That's what they're celebrating, this time when Judas Maccabee finally rededicated the temple back to the worship of God. Now, there's a point I want to make about this if you go over to John 10. And it's this. Jesus Christ kept this feast, the feast of the dedication of the temple. John 10, verse 22 and 23, and it was at Jerusalem, the feast of the dedication, and it was winter. And Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch, and the Jews came round about him and said unto him, how long do you make us doubt? If you're the Christ, tell us plainly. But you see what's going on here, is that Jesus Christ was there in the temple keeping this holiday that was a national holiday. Now, this is significant to us doctrinally. For this reason, there are religious people that will come knocking on your door and so on, trying to get you into conversations, religious conversations. They'll teach that it's idolatry to salute the flag. They'll teach that if you celebrate July 4th, you are committing idolatry. If you celebrate Thanksgiving, if you celebrate Mother's Day or Father's Day, that these are idolatrous and you must not keep them. But you understand, the days that God says you're not to keep are those pagan holidays that are religious. But can you keep a national holiday? Jesus did it. This is no different than July 4th would be to us when we gained independence. Do you see what I'm getting at? So it's significant, I think, at least to have this in your arsenal so that you understand why it is that we keep such things as 4th of July, or Thanksgiving, or Mother's and Father's Day. those things are actually okay. And there's other places that when I come up with a Thanksgiving booklet, you'll see that there were fast days that were authorized by the king, that were kept by the Jews, kept by Jesus Christ. Purim, for instance, is another one. Those days were authorized and okay to keep, although they weren't commanded by God. Okay, back to Daniel 8. Now Daniel is given the interpretation of everything he saw. Daniel 8, verse 15 through 19. And it came to pass, when I, even I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid, and I fell on my face. But he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face towards the ground, but he touched me and set me upright. And he said, behold, I'll make you know what shall be in the end, the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed, the end shall be. So Daniel saw here the appearance of a man, and it was the angel Gabriel. And the voice commanded Gabriel to explain the vision to Daniel. Now I want us to think for a moment here, because Gabriel is a very high-ranking angel. The book of Enoch is where we get this, by the way, not one of the books in the Bible, but the book of Enoch is the one that tells us that he is an archangel along with six other archangels. Very high-ranking, however, but they appear to be the highest-ranking angel. And here's what Gabriel said about himself. The angel answers and says, I am Gabriel that stands in the presence of God. So my point in all of this is, okay, whose voice do you think was commanding Gabriel? I don't think there's other angels higher than him. It's probably the very voice of God, wasn't there? Maybe Jesus Christ saying to Gabriel, explain this to him. So anyway, so awesome is the appearance of this magnificent angel that Daniel becomes afraid. He falls down, apparently, almost unconscious from the experience, and then Gabriel's restorative touch revives him. But he's told there is an appointed time for the end, and it will be the end of God's indignation, and he's going to let Daniel know what's going to occur. And then the angel explains in verse 20 through 22. The ram which you saw having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia, and the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that's between his eyes is the first king. Of course, that's, again, Alexander. Now, that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. That is, they divided the nation, and each had their own power. And then it says down here in verse 23, and in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. And so Antiochus is the one this is speaking about, a vicious king, and he would be the master of intrigue, that is, dark sentences, and he would be crafty, and he would be deceitful. Verse 24, and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power, and he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And so it would be not by his own power that he would be this great and powerful ruler. Well, whose power do you think this would be? It would have to be demonic. It would have to be Satan. And I really believe when you see the beast's power, who's he going to be inspired by? Who's going to be empowering him? Satan himself. And I think whenever we have these single great rulers like this over the beast's power, I think that Satan is right there. So anyway, he's going to then attack God's people with, I believe, demonic vengeance. And this shows in the next verse that he is a type of the end-time beast. And through his policy also, he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself. You remember this where it says craft to prosper in his hand? You remember another place later on where it says by flatteries? he'll gain prestige and power by flatteries. And that's what it's talking about here. He'll magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall he destroy many. And so we see that there's going to be peace, but there is no peace. But he's going to make treaties and agreements with others, and he's going to leverage himself into a position of great power. And then he'll stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And here again, remember the image we saw of Daniel, of his dream? Why, the image was destroyed how? Not with human hands. And it mentions that. It's from God. It's from God's hand. And so we see this happening in this very case of Antiochus, that he made himself to be godlike, and he made coins with his name as over the top of it is Theos Epiphanes, God manifest. And with treachery and intrigue, he made peace by treaties. And this end time beast will do the very same and use his power to destroy, and even going to fight against Jesus Christ when he returns. Remember, the battle of Armageddon comes. The kings of the east come down and they come into Megiddo. And there the battle of Armageddon takes place. Jesus Christ comes, and then the beast power will train his guns on Christ himself. And then he's going to be broken. But it's not going to be by a human hand. It's going to be by the Almighty God at his return. But Antiochus found himself pillaging a temple, as he was often wont to do, of another people. And there the people resisted him courageously, and he was really hurt by this and frustrated. At the same time, he got the news that the Maccabees had smashed his troops and rededicated the temple. This caused him so much distress that he actually got consumption. Now, the way that Josephus describes it is that it seems like a cancer hit him, but it says that his whole stomach began to convulse, and worms ate him up from the inside. And he was in such pain from this for so long that he called all of his friends and associates, and he confessed to him that he was going to die. And he said the reason he believed was because of the way he had treated the Jews and treated the temple of Jerusalem. And he admitted this upon his deathbed, that this was his punishment for what he had done. Then the angel concludes in verse 26 and 27, "And the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. Wherefore shut up the vision, for it shall be for many days. And I, Daniel, fainted, and I was sick certain days. Afterward I rose up, and I did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it." And so think for a minute about a vision that I've told you. I'm sure some of you grimaced when I talked about some of this. But when he saw the vision, he was sick. It literally made him sick emotionally, psychologically, and physically. And yet he didn't fully understand it. Now, we can understand this vision today. Why? Well, we're not better than Daniel. We have the New Testament, don't we? We have Revelation, we have Christ's words in Matthew 24 and all of that. And so we have that to help us understand. But let's go to Revelation 13. The angel said that the vision of the evenings and the mornings were true. And that means it's absolutely going to happen. It was a future event. And it would be many days also for the future beast as well. But all of this that happened to Antiochus Epiphanes was written as a type. And the Jews, and even some people today, wonder why. Why would God even allow such a thing to happen to a people? Well, one reason would be that the transgression, it says, was full. The people of God had let many, many things slip and were not living his way. But there's another point I'd like to make in all of this. Why is the Old Testament even written? It's written for us upon whom the ends of the age have come. And so we have this graphic history of a persecution. And if we didn't have it, I bet you anything, we would not even believe what is going to come. We'd never even believe it was going to happen. But we have it already happened in type. So we know when it happens that it's going to happen, and we're prepared for it. And the Bible is written for us. Revelation 13, verse 4 and 7. 4 through 7. And they worship the dragon, which gave power unto the beast. And they worship the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? Who's able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. Doesn't this sound like something we've already heard about? And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And then 2 Thessalonians 2. The idol that Antiochus set up became known to the Jews as an abomination. And it was one that made the temple desolate. And they called it the abomination of desolation. And all of this existed to picture a final fulfillment in prophecy. A final beast is coming like Antiochus. And he's going to sit in the very temple of God. And he's going to say that he is God. 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 3. Speaking about the end time, he says this, Let no man, Paul writes, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. You see, it's coming, and we've had a type of this here. And Jesus spoke of this back to Matthew 24. Jesus spoke of this and referred to these verses we've just read in Daniel 8. In Matthew 24, verse 15, Jesus says, When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place. And then he says, Whoever reads, let him understand. Well, I think we do understand. But this is what Antiochus did. He put a statue of Jupiter Olympus in the temple, and there's going to come another temple. A temple is going to be built. Sacrifices are going to be offered. And this is what's going to happen. He says when this guy comes down there and sits in the temple, declaring that he's God, let those that are in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of the house. Don't let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. And then pray that your flight is not in the winter or the Sabbath day, for then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake those days shall be shortened. So you see, this is right before, isn't it? Right before the tribulation. This abomination is going to be set up that was typed out. So back to Daniel 12. Daniel 12. How long will this end time be? And it says, Daniel explains this elsewhere in chapter 12, verse 5 through 13. Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, there stood two, the one on this side of the bank of the river, and the other on that side of the bank of the river. Verse 6, And one said unto the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, How long shall it be to the end of these wonders? And I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven, and swore by him that lives forever, that it shall be for a time, times and a half. And when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. And I heard, but I understood not. Then said I, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said, Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. And from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that makes desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Okay, did you get that? This is a little bit longer than 1,260, isn't it? 1290. Blessed is he that waits and comes to the 1305 and 30 days. But you go your way till the end be, for you shall rest, that is, sleep in the ground, and then stand in your lot at the end of days. Now these days are about the end time. The 1150 days were pertaining to Antiochus, and he was a type of what was to come. It has been speculated that the 335 days end at Christ's return, right? Whoever waits till that time, 1335 days, 1260 days before Christ returns, the church goes into a place of safety, and a tribulation for 3.5 years, or time and a half takes place. 30 days before that is 1290 days. The beast will sit in Jerusalem, he will stop the sacrifices there, and this is 1290 days in before Christ's return. If you go back to Matthew 24, 45 days before God's people, before this, God's people will now be outlawed and unable to preach the gospel. The work will be done. I'm sure there will begin severe persecution. There'll be a good 75 days before they go into a place of safety. Like the plagues of Egypt, God's people had to suffer. Some of those first plagues came on God's people. Here we get a time period. But when it begins to happen, we know what? We know how many days. It's not going to be forever here. It's only going to be a month or so, a couple of months here, and we're going to be out of this. But we're going to suffer some pre-tribulation birth pangs, and you can be sure of that. In Matthew 24, I say this by way of reminder. A bad time is coming, but when we see it come, realize it's going to be short, like a woman in labor. But also, we can take some encouragement from this. Matthew 24, verse 32. Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So likewise you, when you shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Truly I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. And so he says, the generation that sees these things begin to occur will not end without seeing Jesus Christ's return. We're seeing these things occur. We're seeing America start to come down now. And it's a little scary. It's a little frightening. But I remind you of this. Take heart. Yes, a time of trouble is coming. But after that, a time of incredible healing and prosperity for these poor, suffering people in the world. And us, kings and priests, majestic and powerful, spirit beings, having eternal life that can never be hurt again. And it's so well worth it to be the bride of Jesus Christ and to rule with him forever, doing good everywhere we go. Man, it's a wonderful future. But there's going to be a little pain as the earth rocks when the tribulation comes. And Daniel 8 was written so that God's people, the Jews, would know what was going to come. And it was written as a type for us to understand also what would happen at the end of the age. It's a little gloomy in one sense, but take heart. What we see is coming is going to be very wonderful in the end.